Okay, good morning. Good to see everyone out this morning. We have a number of our folks traveling, as you might expect, but we have a number of visitors among us today, so good to see you. And welcome to our class. We're the Life of Christ study, second quarter. Do a little review from where we were Wednesday night, and then we'll get into our text this morning. We'll be in Luke 16 when we actually start our new stuff this morning. Looking at the periods of the life of Christ, we're down to that last part of his life before the crucifixion. In fact, we're down probably in the 3 months, 3 or 4 months before the crucifixion time frame here now. So it's getting down to that narrow part there. Remember this slide, that the Jews are wanting to kill him. They've already made their mind up. And even in the lesson today, as we get down toward the end of it, you're going to see that intensity rising into another level. After he raises Lazarus, it gets even stronger, to the point that he doesn't even want to be in Judea after this. So they're already getting to that point there. So back it up to what we did Wednesday night, quick review there. After the Feast of Dedication, Jesus leaves Jerusalem and goes back across the Jordan River to the east side, to Perea, area of Ruba here at Antibus, on the right side there on the map in the orange, and spent some time over there. Some of the things that happened there, recorded in Luke. He goes to the house of one of the rulers of the Pharisees, one of the chief Pharisees, and is eating with him, and it's on the Sabbath day. And of course, we've had a lot of times when he's had issues healing people on the Sabbath day, and the reaction of the Pharisees when he does that, accusing him of working on the Sabbath and whatever. So he asked them, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? And just wait for an answer. And they didn't answer it. They had nothing to say to him. And so he heals this man of dropsy on the Sabbath. And he turns around and reasons with him and says, if you had a donkey or an oxen that fell in the pit on the Sabbath, would you get it out? Now, is this person not more important than your animal there? And then he talks to him about, just one series after another, as he deals with the Pharisees here, talks about humility. When you go into a feast, you go to sit at the head table, you go to the best seats, and you shouldn't do that. He said, go sit at the lower seats. If you're supposed to be at the head table, somebody will come get you and move you up there. Don't exalt yourself. Let others exalt you. Humble yourselves. You'll be exalted. He talks about the cost of discipleship. No man goes out to build a house without looking at the total cost so he can start and finish it. You don't go to war with somebody that's got 10,000 soldiers. And I mean, you got 10,000, they got 20,000. You're going to say, wait a minute, that's not going to work out. So he said, look at it. What's it cost to be a disciple? What it cost everything? And he talks about hating father and mother and brothers and sisters and put them in the proper relationship between me and them. I come first. Serving God comes first before everything else. So that's the cost of discipleship. And then we wound up with the three lost items, the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the lost son. We talked about them. And the son finally came to himself and said, I've got to go back to my father. So he does that. The father receives him back joyfully. And we'll talk about that more just in a minute. I'll talk about that one in a minute. He talks about serving two masters. You can't serve two masters. You go hate the one, love the other. You can't serve God in that one. You've got to take your choice. And look at this verse in 1 John 2. I read it the other day again. It kind of caught me a little different. Love not the world. Take that phrase by itself. Love not the world. We usually read it so fast for this. Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. Love not the world. Neither the things that are in the world. What's left? Nothing there, okay? Nothing. Because you can't love the world and love God at the same time. That's his whole point. So let's go back to the prodigal son just 1 minute here. We talked about this. It came to himself. We talked about that a little bit last time. He finally got down to this low point where he saw what he was doing, and he was so hungry, and he would eat the pig feed, and he came to himself. He finally realized I've got to do something different. When we're in sin, I don't care if it's one of us that's gone off the deep end somewhere, or if we just have a sin in our life that's bothering us. We've got to realize that. And we've got to realize that I've got to go back to my Father. I've got to go back. I've got to make the first move. I've got to get up out of my sin, whatever it is. And I've got to go back. And thankfully, the Father's waiting for me. He's there. And he's waiting for me to come back. If it's a sin I've committed, I go to him in prayer. And he joyfully waits for me, because there's going to be rejoicing. It'll be great rejoicing. There'll be more rejoicing than the angels of heaven over one sinner repents. Remember that? We had that verse last time. So I turn around, I go back. My Father's waiting on me, and there's great joy. That's one thing I'm going to take off this slide up here. In this parable we had here, we had a jealous brother. Our older brother's not jealous. He's right there beside the Father waiting for us. So when we think about our lives and where we are, we've got to get up. We've got to go back to the Father. Back to our first love. Remember, John wrote to the church at Ephesus in Revelation, you lost your first love. You left your first love. Sometimes we do that. We have to try and go back. Okay, getting into the new stuff for today. We're in Luke 16, start about the middle of the chapter, verse 19. We're going to start off with the rich man and Lazarus. A very familiar story. And rich man was clothed in fine clothing and had about everything he wanted. Lived in splendor, as the phrase is used there, and fared sumptuously. Everything that a rich man might have. And then there's Lazarus, the other character. Lazarus the beggar, full of sores. And he was laid. Notice that. He didn't go to the rich man's gate and lay down or sit there every day and begging. He was laid there. The implication is that he couldn't even get there by himself. Somebody took him there and laid him down there. Lazarus. Hungry. All he wanted is a few scraps. Just give me a few crumbs from the table. I just need a little bit of something to eat. The rich man had everything. Well, they both die, which is the point of the story. They both die. And think about Matthew 25 a minute. The judgment scene where the sheep and the goats, and one goes the right hand, one goes the left hand. There's a parting, the separation goes on. That's what happened here. Lazarus goes to the arms of Abraham. And the rich man is in Hades in torment. Now, he begs for mercy. Send Lazarus, Father Abraham. Send him that he just dip the tip of his, just a little bit of drop of water on his finger and put it on the tip of my tongue. I'm tormented in these flames. Look at verse 25. Get your Bible there. In chapter 16, verse 25. What do you see there? How did the rich man live in his life? How did Lazarus live in his life? What's the contrast in verse 25? Totally opposite. The rich man had everything. Lazarus had nothing. And now what's Lazarus got? Total comfort. Abraham's bosom. What's the rich man got? Torment. Torment. Abraham says, you can't do that. I can't send Lazarus there. There's a great gulf. There's a chasm between us, and nobody can come from you to here or here to there. Can't go either direction. Can't do it. So then the rich man said, well, I got five brothers left. Send somebody back and let them warn them. Don't let them come to this place. Don't let them come to this place of torment. And he says, they got Moses and the prophets. There's all kind of teaching for them. It's there. All they got to do is listen to it. The rich man says, No. But if someone came back from the dead, if someone came back from the dead, they would surely listen to them. There's a question. What did a rich man fail to do during his life? There's no one answer. What did he fail to do? Think about all the things. Compassion for Lazarus? None. Sharing? Caring? Helping others? Paying any attention to Moses and the prophets? Nothing. Send one back from the dead and they'll listen. Did they? Did the people listen when one came back from the dead? Do people listen today to one who came back from the dead? Too many don't. That's exactly what Jesus did. He came back from the dead and he delivered his message. And so many then turned away. So many today will not hear what he said. All right, moving now to Luke 17. There's a warning there. Tim, read verse 1, Tim, Luke 17. What translation you got? It is? New American Standard. Okay, listen. There's some different wording here. I'm going to get out here. Read it, Tim, please.
He said to his disciples, it is inevitable that stumbling blocks come.
Okay, it's inevitable that stumbling blocks are going to come. Somebody got a different translation besides, what did you say, New American Standard? Somebody got something else? About stumbling blocks. New King James says, it is impossible that no offenses will come. Offenses are going to come. That's the point, okay? We'll read here. It's a little hard to understand, but it makes a big point. It is impossible, but that offenses will come. Literally, the words literally mean it's impossible for offenses not to come. They're going to come. The devil's powerful influence makes it practically out of the question to expect there will be no spiritual destructive influences these persons experience in this world. The devil's after us, okay? That's what this verse is saying. Such temptations are bound to, that's the New International. Such temptations are bound to come in every human being's life. And here's the point. The word offenses here is otherwise translated occasions of stumbling blocks, things that cause people to sin, different terms used for this thing. And really the word that's translated ought to be much stronger in our language than what it really is. It should be fatal traps. Traps that are to catch and kill. And they're going to come either through immoral influences, pleasurable seduction, false teaching, material gain, one way or the other. Stumbling blocks. Things that cause us to sin. They're going to come. The devil's there. They're going to happen. But what's he saying here? Woe to you who causes these things to come to another person. Woe to you if you're the stumbling block. Woe to you if you cause another person to sin. It's better off for you than what? I had the picture last quarter. We had the same verse from earlier. Part. I had a picture of a millstone around a guy's neck and he's diving into the sea. Better off to be drowned in the sea with a millstone than cause someone else to stumble. And who's he talking to here? It's not the Pharisees anymore he's been talking to. He's talking to his disciples. He's talking to his disciples. He's talking to us. Be careful that through your teaching, through your influence, through whatever, that you don't cause someone else to stumble. Leah moves on in those next few verses. It says, if your brother does sin against you, and it comes to you and he repents, what are you going to do? You're going to forgive him. And he sins again, he comes back to you and repents again, what are you going to do? You're going to forgive him again. And again. And again. And as often as he repents, you're going to forgive it. Then in verse 5, disciples, after hearing all this, said, Lord, increase our faith. We need more faith to get through this. That's where our theme for the year came from. We kind of personalized it and said, increase my faith instead of increase our faith. But increase our faith. He talks about a man who's been out as a servant. He's been out in the field working all day long. Just picture this man. He's been out. Of course, these days we don't have chopping cotton anymore. But some grew up chopping cotton. Been out in the field working, slaving all day long. Comes in the house, tired, worn out, long day, dirty. He comes in. It's time for you to eat. You're the master. What do you expect him to do? You're going to say, oh, I know you're tired. You've been working hard all day. Here, sit down. Let me fix you some food here. I got it ready for you. That's not what happens. What happens? I don't care if you're tired. Fix my food. Feed me. Take care of me. And then when you got me taken care of, then you can go back and find you something else to eat. The little section closes with, and I changed this slide a little bit. I added this word say in there. If you read that verse, what's that, about verse 10 or so? Yeah. Likewise, when you've done all that you think that you are commanded to do, like that servant did, say, we are unprofitable servants. We have done what our duty to do. I don't believe that faith is teaching that when I have done all I can do, I am still an unprofitable servant. I think it's my attitude toward it. I say that I am an unprofitable servant. I can go out and do good and teach others and do whatever. And all I do in the service of for the Lord, it can be good stuff. What's my attitude, though? I've just done my duty. So I think the word say has to be in there. As my attitude is that I've just done what's my duty, Lord. That's all I'm doing. It's not like I'm good for nothing. I shouldn't get that attitude. I'm unprofitable servant. No. That's the attitude we have, though, is that we've just done our duty. Does that make sense, what I'm trying to say? Have I got thought about that? All right, let's move over to the book of John now. John chapter 11. We'll spend the rest of our time in there. As we talk about a different Lazarus now, not the rich man and Lazarus, but we talk about Lazarus, the brother of Mary and Martha. John chapter 11. All right. Focus your mind think about the map a minute. Jerusalem here, Mount of Olives is over here. It's a valley that runs down between them here. And just across the top of the Mount of Olives is a little village of Bethany. And I see it better here. All right. This map here, the north end of the Kidron Valley, looking down the valley. And then Jerusalem's on the right up here. And the Mount of Olives is on the left. So if you leave Jerusalem, you go down through the Kidron Valley, back up at Mount of Olives, and just across the crest over there is where Bethany is. All right? So that's where Lazarus lives with his two sisters, Mary and Martha. Now, I've got a quote on the slide. It's a bit long. I'll read it to you, though. It's from Mary Britnell, who's made several trips there. And this idea of relationship between Jerusalem and the village of Bethany, where they live. He says numerous times in Jesus' ministry, he would take advantage of the opportunities to get away from the crowds. We've talked about some of those already, the period of retirement. In John 11, read the story of the death and resurrection of Lazarus. In the midst of this story, in verse 18, we're told that Bethany is about 2 miles from Jerusalem. While 2 miles isn't that far, it was far enough to get Jesus away from the crowds of the city. Okay? We can learn more about this once we look at a map. In this case, a topographical map. And I use the picture there instead of a topographical map, but you see it. You'll notice that Jerusalem's located west of the Mount of Olives. Bethany's located on the southeastern slope of the Mount of Olives. So it's on the opposite side of the Mount of Olives from where Jerusalem is. So for Jesus to travel from Jerusalem to Bethany, he would have to leave the city, go down through the Kidron Valley, up the coast to the top of the Mount of Olives, and across the crown of the mount, and descend down to the other side just a little ways. It's not down to the next bottom, it's on the edge. The perfect place for Jesus to stay. Mount of Olives is slightly higher in elevation than what Jerusalem is. So if you go across the top of the Mount of Olives, down to the city of Bethany, you can't even see Jerusalem. Okay. So he would be 2 miles away from the city, and yet it's out of his sight, away from the crowd. So look at it here on this one. This is a computer-generated picture. We've talked about this before, the model of the temple type thing. This would be the southern side. You're looking kind of northeast up through here. So here's the valley, Kidron Valley coming down through here. Mount of Olives, so Bethany would be just across the crown of the top of the Mount of Olives. So you go down through the valley, back up over there. Okay, just a little bit for that. So, Jesus receives word that he's not in Jerusalem. He's not anywhere around there. He receives word that Lazarus is sick. Okay. And it says, the one you love is sick. Jesus had a relationship with Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. Special relationship. Very close friendship, apparently, with them. And he states that this death has a purpose. That purpose is to glorify God. So we're going to see how that plays out as we go down through here. Jesus waits 2 more days after he gets word that Lazarus is sick before he leaves where he is to travel to Jerusalem. And he finally tells the disciples, let's return to Judea. And oh, wait a minute. They kind of almost come apart. Wait a minute. That's where they wanted to stone you. That's where they're trying to kill you. That's where the intensity of them killing you has grown now to this pitch fever. You go back there, they're going to kill you, Master. Jesus talks to them about, well, Lazarus is sleeping. He's sick. Well, that's okay. He'll wake up. Finally, Jesus tells him, Lazarus is dead, and we got to go back there. And Thomas speaks up and says, okay, we're going to die. We're going back. So when Jesus gets back to Bethany, as he approaches, Lazarus has been dead 4 days now. So there's no doubt. No doubt he's dead. Okay. Mourners are there. They've already taken him, wrapped him in the grave clothes with the spices and things they would normally do. He's in a tomb, and the rock is rolled across the tomb. He's dead. He's buried. He's sealed up. Many of the more. So Martha runs out to meet Jesus and says, Master, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. And they get this little conversation there. Jesus tells him, well, he'll rise again. And she said, oh, I know he'll rise in the resurrection. No, Mary, have faith. Verse 22. She said, I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give this to you. It's obvious Mary has, and Martha and Lazarus have been around Jesus before. This is not the first time they've encountered him. They have a faith, a deep faith. I know whatever you ask God, he'll give it to you. Verse 22. 23, he says, your brother's going to rise again. She says, oh, I know he's going to rise in the resurrection day. So you see even there that teach you that they understand. They've had from Jesus in the past. Understand the resurrection. Now Jesus gets another one of those I ams of John. He says, I am the resurrection and the life. I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, this is us. He who believes in me, though he may die, he shall live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. You believe in me, you die, you're going to live. You believe in me, you're going to live because you're going to never die spiritually again. He asked Martha, do you believe this? Do you believe this? And her answer is, yes, Lord. I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who came to this world. It's a mouthful. I believe, I have total confidence, that you are the Christ, the Messiah, the one that said was coming, Old Testament prophets, you are the Christ, the Son of God, who has left heaven and came to this world. So she goes, leaves, and tells Mary that the Master is here. And so she leaves to go out to meet him as well. And the mourners follow her. They think she's getting up from the house and she's going back to the tomb so she can mourn there. And when she approaches Jesus, she's crying. She's weeping. And Jesus is touched by it. In verse 35, we have that famous shortest verse in the Bible where Jesus is overcome with the emotion. And Jesus weeps. They go to the tomb. Picture of a couple of tombs, caves, cut into the rocks. This one actually says, it's Lazarus' tomb up here. Jesus told him to take away the stone. Take away the big stone that's closing that door. Take it away. Well, the sister speaks up and says, wait a minute, Lord. He's been dead 4 days. There's going to be an odor. Don't do that. Glory of God is about to be shown. Jesus prays to the Father. And he says, I know what you're going to do. I know you can do. I know what you will do through me. But I'm going to say it out loud so the people around it can understand it. So they will know what's going on. And then when he's prayed to the Father, he says in a loud voice. And just picture you standing there. You're standing around this hole in the cave up here where this man's buried and wrapped in grave clothes, been there for 4 days. And here's Jesus standing there. And he cries out in a big loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. He said, what's going to happen? Lazarus comes out, wrapped in the grave clothes, after 4 days of being dead. Now, here's the interesting part. What would you have done? What would you have done? Would you have believed in Jesus and who he was at that point? He has just raised a man, called him out of a grave, he's been dead for 4 days. What impression is that going to have on you? Others They right off to tell the Pharisees what's going on. That's the point I'm going to get to. How can some believe when they saw him call a man out of the grave for 4 days, and others can't wait to go tell the Pharisees who they know are trying to kill him? And which group would I have been in if I'd been there? So this, as I said, cranks the intensity up another notch with the Pharisees. So the chief priests and the Pharisees get the council together, the Sanhedrin, and they assemble together and they say, what are we going to do? And notice what they said. This man's working many signs. How many times in last quarter and this quarter have we talked about, give us a sign? Give us a sign. Remember that? Over and over. They would say, well, give us a sign. And every time we did that, I would say, what's he done already? He's made the blind see, the lame walk, the deaf hear. I mean, we just, all the things he's done, he raised the widow's son at Nain. He had done these things, but they couldn't get it through their head. Give us a sign. Prove to us who you are. But now what they're saying, oh, he works many signs. I think they finally got it. Caiaphas, who was the high priest. High priesthood had been really messed up by now. It's a political thing. The Romans actually put him in power. He turned to tell the Sanhedrin, you know nothing at all. Think about that. Now, that's what he's telling his cohorts there. You know nothing at all. Don't you consider it's expedient for us that one man should die for the people and not the whole nation perish? Now, how's he looking at it? How's he looking at it? If this thing keeps on, it'll stir up the Romans. They're going to come in here and wipe us out or cause us trouble. We're going to lose our political clout. What's the best thing to happen? Kill him and get out of the way, right? It's better for one man to perish, this man, Jesus, than to stir up and mess up our whole nation we've got. He's looking at it from a physical standpoint, nothing to do with the spiritual side. And then he prophesies. I don't think he realizes he's prophesying, but the Spirit speaking through him. That Jesus would die for the nation, now it flips the other side, the spiritual side. Jesus would die for the nation, not for that nation only, but he would gather together into one, all of God's children are scattered abroad. We've already talked about and bringing the Gentiles in. Here's another reference to that. And then that bottom line on the slide up there, from that day they were trying to kill him. Before they'd just been looking for a real reason. Now they say, we got no choice. He's got to die. To spare our nation. So he leaves and goes to a place called Ephraim. Don't know where that is exactly. Two or three different places that I read. Here's Jerusalem. So I put Ephraim up here near Bethel, about 20 miles away. Others have it over here in the Judean wilderness, next to, closer to Jericho. He was out of the city. It's a big thing. Now, our verse stops, our text today stops at verse 54 right there. But let's look at 55 one minute. 55, many of the scholars think he's spent some time in Ephraim because the very next verse says the Passover of the Jews was near. Now we're going to stop for John for a while. We're going to get back some Luke and Mark, some other passages before we get ready for this part here. But the Passover is near. That's the Passover when he's going to die. That's how close we are to his death at this point. All right, a couple of viewpoints right quick. What's the point of forgiving our brother? How many times going to forgive him? As many times as he sins and asks forgiveness. Forgive him. Unprofitable service. We do our duty. We do our very best. We do our very best. That's all the master asks. We got 5 talents, use 5 talents. You got 2, use 2. You got 1, use 1. We do our best. And then this powerful statement that Martha made. Yes, Lord, I believe you're the Christ, the Son of God, that's come to the world. And then what the high priest says, this man's got to die. Let's our whole nation perish. Next time we pick up in Luke 17 and kind of follow off where we left off today, and we jump over and pick up, we've been in Mark for a good while, pick up to Mark chapter 10 and get a partial report of that, okay? All right, I've been running over every time, about 2 minutes short today, so I'll give you back a little time I stole the other classes, okay? Thanks.